Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Good Humans Podcast with me, Cooper Chapman, chatting to the world's best about the inspiring stories that got them to where they are today.
What's going on, you good humans? Welcome to guest episode 150 of Good Humans Podcast with performance nutritionist and dietitian, the X-Fit dietitian, Lauren Nash. This lady is incredible. Not only does she talk the talk and have incredible information around dietitian and performance, she also walks the walk. She just recently completed a full Ironman over in New Zealand, which is an amazing feat, and we talk all about it in this episode. A big thank you, of course, to Drink a Rep, the sponsors of this podcast. They have been for a very long time, and I absolutely love these guys. If you haven't heard of them before, it is a brain nutrition drink, or you can also take their capsules or powder. So it's all been developed by a clinical neuroscientist, putting in millions of dollars worth of clinical studies to make sure that this product actually works. So if you head over to their website, drinkarepa.com, you can learn all about the science, and you can also pick up some of their products. It's a black currant, basically. So it's got a beautiful neuroberry black currant from over in New Zealand, which is full of anthocyanins, a beautiful purple that you get in black currant. Also a bunch of L-theanine, which is a calming stuff you find in green tea, and also pine bark, which is a pine bark extract, with a thing called exogenol, which is, also really good for your brain health. So if you head over to their website, drinkarepa.com, you can use the code GOODHUMAN, get a big 25% off. But most importantly, go check out the science, go read some of the studies, and learn all about the benefits you're going to see for short-term brain performance. Think of it like an energy drink, but also long-term brain health. Big thanks to them for always supporting. Also, a huge thank you to Wild Earth Australia. So Wild Earth have been helping me gear up for the UTA 100 kilometer ultra marathon that I've got coming up in May. All of my equipment, they have me sorted. I've been getting all of my nutrition equipment from there as well. So you're going to learn throughout this episode different things that I've been taking for my nutrition, from gels to carb water to a whole range of other stuff. So I've been picking all of that up at Wild Earth Australia, as well as all my running shoes, all my running vests, and everything else in between. And Wild Earth have done a very special thing for me. If you want to join up to their Wild Earth full-time discount deal, you can head to the link in the show notes. Click on the link. It's going to take you to a little sign-up form. Sign up where it says group, I think it says, hit the Good Human Pod, and you're going to get the Wild Earth wallet pass added to your phone, or you're going to have an online portal that you're going to be able to get discounted prices on everything at Wild Earth Australia for every day of the week. So if you want to learn all about that, click on the show notes. Big thanks to Wild Earth for continuing to sponsor my running efforts and also my nutrition for this race as well. Okay, Lauren Nash, this lady is a legend. She works under the Fight Dietitian, a guy called Jordan Sullivan, and I've been following both of their stuff for a while. They work with a lot of incredible high-performance athletes in the fighting scene, from UFC fighters Alex Volkanovski and Israel Adesanya, and plenty more incredible top-level athletes. But they also work with a lot of endurance athletes, which is why I was so fascinated to get to chat to Lauren. As I said at the start of this episode, not only is she someone who has incredible depth of information to share around nutrition, she also has done plenty of endurance events herself, so she can share from experience what works for her and also the do's and don'ts when it comes to endurance running and endurance sport with nutrition. I absolutely love this episode. I got so much out of it. If you guys enjoyed the episode, do me a huge favor. Go and hit that like or subscribe button. Send it on to a friend. If you find any information in this podcast helpful, make sure you share it with a friend, because that's the best way we can spread these positive bits of information to a wider community. Also, if you enjoy it, make sure you tag both myself and Lauren on your Instagram story. Share it around, and we'd love to hear what you think of the episode. That's enough for me. Let's jump into the episode. Welcome to Good Humans Podcast, Lauren Nash.
How you going, Lauren?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to having a chat, and it was great to just have a little bit of a get to know you quick session just then.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like we're very aligned. We're very into trying to help people live a better life, basically. You work in the field of being a dietitian, being a high performance nutritionist for athletes, and helping them achieve goals that can be quite often looked at as unachievable. And nutrition, what I'm learning through this challenge I'm currently going through for 100 days to 100 Ks, is pretty much the most important thing. And you know all about that. So we're going to get into that later in this chat on how I can better fuel myself for my run, what I should be doing in training, what I should be doing on race day, and everything else in between. But first, we're going to get to know your story. You are quite an incredible athlete yourself. You've got a very interesting journey, which I've done a bit of research through your socials, but getting to have a face-to-face through Zoom chat right now and learn about the story is very exciting. But the first question I open with is the same for everyone, and it's something that you told me off air. You do practice every single day with a friend of yours overseas in England. So what are three things you're grateful for in the last 24 hours of your life?
Ooh, three things I'm grateful for. All right. I am grateful to genuinely enjoy exercise, not see it as a form of needing to, you know, burn calories or lose weight. That's something I've always been grateful for. I am grateful to live in a state with beautiful weather, and I am grateful to have a good knowledge of health and nutrition that a lot of people, you know, wouldn't be able to have.
I love that. Beautiful gratitude. Such a nice way to reflect on life and go, Actually, I love the first one that you said there, actually enjoying exercise. I've been thinking about it a little lately with the training that I've been doing. And not looking at it as a chore, but going, okay, I've got to tick off all these things in my training program. But shifting that mindset and that perspective of, I don't have to do this. I get to do this. I get to go out and be outside, enjoy being active. It's not only good for my health, it's good for my well-being. It's good for all aspects of my life. So yeah, changing to like, I love doing this, and understanding and seeing and feeling the importance of it and the joy that it can bring is very nice. It made me reflect on that too. I need to change that mindset a little bit. I think with a few of my training runs, when that 4 a.m. alarm goes off and I'm like, oh, I got to shift that mindset. So thank you for bringing that awareness. But I'm excited to get to know your story today. I don't know too much about it. So let's go back to the start. As much as you're willing to share, do you want to let me know what your sort of upbringing was like as a kid, going up into high school, where you grew up, siblings, family life? What do I kind of need to know about the early days of your life that shaped you to be the incredible woman you are today?
Yeah, for sure. I feel like whenever I think back to kind of being a kid or just going through school, I feel like a lot of it is kind of just overrun by sport, because I've pretty much done some form of sport since I was very, very young. So when I think back to childhood memories, of course, there's like family holidays and all of that stuff. But I think a big part of it for me is sport. I grew up on the Gold Coast in Queensland. I got one brother, he did soccer. So I don't know, maybe I got into sport because of him, but I did, you know, dancing, I did AFL, I did Taekwondo for a little bit. But the sport that really, I guess, had the biggest influence on my life is it's a bit random, but I did artistic roller skating. So, you know, when you watch the Olympics and the ice skaters, like they do jumps and spins and the routines, I did that, but on roller. And I wanted to get into ice skating, but my mum said to me, she said, if you're any good at it, I don't want to sit in a cold rink every day and freeze, you know, while you're at training. So I got into roller and I did that for about 13 years. So I think I was maybe 7 or 8 when I started. I can't quite remember, but to be honest, if I'm going to talk about my childhood, that was probably the biggest part of it. I competed, I trained, obviously I competed at like state, national, international level over the course of those 12 years. You know, going through high school, I had a part-time job to help, you know, my parents pay for like my trips so that I could go overseas and whatever. And I guess my life was pretty much, you know, Monday to Friday school, training 6 days a week, you know, having a casual job on the weekends. So I think from a very young age, I probably learned, you know, a lot of discipline and just kind of being busy and active. It was obviously an awesome chapter of my life. I represented Australia in like America, China. I went to China, I went to New Zealand, Germany, Italy, Spain. So I also got to travel the world for sport, which is incredible and obviously something that I'm so grateful for to this day. But I guess in terms of, you know, how that relates to where I am now, during a couple of those years being in quite, you know, I guess an aesthetic sport, I did start to develop a pretty unhealthy relationship with food. And I'd say during my mid-teens, I started to develop quite a bad eating disorder. And, you know, when you're in it, you don't see it. Everyone else around you is saying, oh my God, you look so thin, blah, blah, blah. My coaches were saying, you don't look strong anymore. And I was like, oh no, I don't notice it kind of thing. And anyway, I guess, you know, it spiraled over the course of a couple of years, and it got to the point where at one nationals, you know, I think I probably missed out on a place in the world team because I just was lacking that strength that I used to have. And that was obviously a bit of a wake up call for me. And my team and my world's team manager introduced me to a nutritionist. And, you know, that was kind of history in terms of that really just helped me to then start turning, I guess, my life around as a young teen. You know, you think you know best and everything like that. So that was a big part of my career, I guess, in terms of, you know, training at an elite level, being, you know, I think I was maybe 14, 15 when this started happening. So obviously like quite easily influenced and thinking that I knew everything. But yeah, I guess that was probably a big part of my career. Obviously I kept skating for a couple of years and everything got a lot better once I finally acknowledged, you know, that I was probably not doing the right thing by my body, and started to actually fuel my performance. So I think for me, that was probably the moment that I knew I wanted to become a dietitian one day. Wow. And while my intentions have probably changed over the years, initially it was because I always said to myself, if I could help one person in the way that my nutritionist had helped me to overcome my eating disorder, then that would probably be, you know, my mission achieved, because I know how much of an impact that had on my sports performance and obviously my health, you know, moving forward. I was only 14, 15 during that period of time. So I knew if I could probably stop that from happening in another young athlete, then that would probably be my purpose achieved. And obviously like that's changed a little bit over the years and we can talk about that. But that is, I guess, probably one of the most defining moments, I would say, of probably my personal and now my professional career. There's probably a bit of a backstory of me.
Wow, that's incredible. You tell that story very well. I've got a few questions I want to pick apart through here. And thank you for being so honest about your eating disorder too. And it's something that I will, if you're happy to have a bit of a chat about it, go into, because I think there's going to be people listening who either are going through something themselves or have a child going through something or have a friend going through something. So reflecting off your journey can be really powerful. But first of all, artistic roller skating. How the hell do you get into artistic roller skating here in Australia? I wouldn't even know where to start on the Gold Coast. I didn't even know it was a sport. I quickly went on your LinkedIn before we went through this. And the last thing I thought I was going to scroll down to the bottom of previous jobs and previous sort of careers was artistic roller skating. So I was going to ask you about that, but I'm glad you brought it up. So how does one get into artistic roller skating? What does competition look like and what does training look like?
Yeah, for sure. Well, like I said, I really wanted to do ice. So then when that was off the table, we just kind of started looking for local clubs. And when my mum was growing up in New South Wales, her parents actually owned a roller skating rink in Sydney. So that was, I think, probably just found a club because, you know, mum had experience like from her childhood as well. I guess for me, in terms of training, I probably don't really remember when I first started, but for the bulk of it, I was pretty much training 5 or 6 days a week, and training sessions were usually anywhere from 2 to 4 hours long. When it comes to competitions, I don't really know what I can compare this to. The closest thing I compare it to is ice skating. I don't know if you've ever watched ice skating, but they'll go out and they'll do like a routine.
Yeah, like a performance.
Yeah. It could be anywhere from 2 to 4 minutes. And ultimately, yeah, you're just working on like jumps, spins, choreography, those types of things. And the competitions are only, you know, your routine itself is max 5 minutes. But yeah, training sessions were pretty much anywhere from 2 to 5 hours after school when I was in school. And then obviously once I graduated, it was a bit more flexible, and then on weekends as well. So yeah, it's funny because I think back to it and I'm like, wow, I kind of did endurance training in a way because my sessions were quite long, but the event itself was like a very short, high intensity, you know, like a 400 meter sprint kind of thing. But yeah, that
kind of like swimmers having to swim kilometers and kilometers just to be ready for their 100 meter race. Like, that's so interesting. What a fascinating thing to grow up. It's like one of those hidden talents that most people don't know, and then one day you just chuck rollerblades on and just like do flips and spins around everyone. Like,
I know, it's so random.
That's so cool. Let's talk about now, if you're willing to, the eating disorder. When you were that young, I mean, it's probably going to be hard to reflect. How old are you now, by the way, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm 26.
Okay. Yeah. So, it's a while ago, but not, you know, in your distant past. It's 10, 12 years ago. Thinking back to that time, what do you put down the reason why you started to, like, what was going on? You were not eating. You were trying to look skinnier for the sake of the competition. Was it your own self-image of yourself? Because you said coaches were saying you're getting too skinny. So it doesn't sound like it was pressure from coaches. I have some friends who are models. My partner's a model, and I've heard some horror stories from that industry of people getting told they have to be skinnier, which can feed into an eating disorder. But when it comes from yourself, I find that even more difficult to deal with because it's that internal voice. So looking back on that time, what do you think maybe started that for you? And how can like a parent maybe who look out for that in their own child?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think, to be honest, whenever I do think back to it, and I think as well, the reason I'm comfortable to share this is because, you know, when it happened, it was like a very traumatizing period of years. Like it definitely had a huge toll on my body and obviously like mental and physical health. But when I look back at it now, I'm so grateful that it happened in a way because I wouldn't have a lot of the things that I have in life now if it wasn't for that experience. So while obviously it was a hard part of my life, I don't necessarily have any kind of, you know, trauma attached to it because I've grown and obviously created the life I've got now because of that chapter. Mm. But I think when I do think back to it, I genuinely feel like it happened out of really good intentions. I was never unhealthy. I've never been overweight. But I do remember I used to be quite a fussy eater. And it got to the point where I was starting to travel overseas for competition. I wasn't traveling with my family all the time. So I had to be, I guess, a little bit more independent. And I was going to different countries. And I kind of told myself, okay, I need to probably start eating a bit healthier and like eating different foods and not being as fussy. So I genuinely, when I think back, it came from a good place, you know, in terms of trying to eat more vegetables or trying to eat more this and that. And then I think it just snowed into a bit extreme in terms of like, I'm no longer allowed to eat chocolate. You know, I can only eat, you know, fruit, vegetables, blah, blah, blah. And then it was just like small things, I guess, around that age are probably influenced by what you see on social media. And then, you know, you'd see things like cow's milk is bad for you. So then I'd start having almond milk when I didn't have dairy allergy. I didn't have lactose intolerance. I just would start going for almond milk because it was lower calorie. So I genuinely think it started from a really good place in terms of wanting to be healthier, but then it just got out of control to the point where I was like, not letting myself eat chocolate. I'd tell myself that, you know, chocolate was bad. If I went out, I'd always like try and look for the lower calorie food. So I think, yeah, it started from a good place, snowballed. In terms of, you know, if you've got a friend or a child or a family member that you're maybe worried about, I would say a couple of things to look out for would probably be one, starting to, you know, just like obsessively track calories or macros, whether that's on their phone or when they're making food choices, kind of only being guided by the calorie and the macro type thing. I'd say as well, potentially starting to restrict things in their diet for no good reason. For example, like myself, I cut out cow's milk and started having low calorie almond milk, like those types of things. Or if, you know, your friend always has a Mocha and then they start having long blacks obsessively. I love long blacks. There's nothing wrong with it. But if for no reason they kind of start making these really low calorie swaps, that can be a little bit of a quiet sign as well. Obviously, body checking is a big one. Potentially even just the types of accounts they follow on social media, the way they talk about themselves, as well as maybe kind of like isolating themselves from social situations where food might be involved. I guess there are a couple of things because whether the person knows it or not, you know, they're putting themselves in positions where maybe they can control their food intake. I think disordered eating comes from a place of wanting to control, have some sort of control. And obviously you can control what you put in your mouth and what you don't. So I think, yeah, that's probably a big one as well.
I love that. Thank you so much. I think that's such a eloquently put breakdown of different things to see. But what I love the way that you broke that down is it's taking stuff out of your diet for good intentions that it's better for your health. But we quite often, especially now with social media, there's just these blanket calls made about certain products and certain things when it doesn't relate specifically to you. We're all individuals. And I know for you working with one-on-one clients, everyone would be so different based on what works for them, their own systems, their own genes, and what actually is going on in every individual person is what matters. Like the milk one's such a perfect example. I did that for ages. I went from cow's milk to oat milk and almond milk for a while thinking that, oh, this is healthier because it's something I saw on Instagram. But then I started to see other information around seed oils and all this stuff. And I'm like, wait, all these fake milk, like milks aren't actually better for you. They're just terrible as well. Anyway, we'll get more up to that stuff once we start talking about some things that I should be fueling myself with and what I shouldn't. But I think that's just a really good thing for people to notice that you don't have to start cutting calories unless you're in it, you know, unless you're starting to become unhealthy. So many people aren't unhealthy, but then try and get healthier, and that actually makes them unhealthy. Is that kind of something that you see quite often?
Yeah, definitely. Or I think as well, people's perceptions of what being healthy and unhealthy is, or that's a big one as well. And we work with a lot of like athletes in weight-based sports. So a big one is obviously combat sport, weightlifting, rowing, horse riding, any sport where obviously body weight is associated. And it kind of works out well that I'm in this field as well, because a lot of those guys and girls, they do struggle with disordered eating, or I guess body dysmorphia, because they've got that weight tied to it. So, you know, for those types of athletes, it's even worse. But for, you know, people in sport or just everyday life where you don't necessarily have a weight attached to, you know, anything, it's just sometimes managing, like, wanting to be healthy, but also not taking it to the extreme level, because it's really hard to come back from that, I find.
That's something that's interesting you brought that up, because I had a girl on recently who's a great friend of mine, Jackie Bell. I don't know if you've heard of her. She's an endurance athlete, youngest to run an ultra marathon on every continent. And she talked to me about this idea of, generally, the way out of anorexia and the way out of an eating disorder is binge eating, which then has a counter effect. So it's just like, it's very rarely talked about binge eating as well, like the opposite side of trying to bring yourself out. So like healthily coming back from an eating disorder. So that's something that's quite important.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, people think of an eating disorder as only being anorexia, so under eating, but binge eating is actually a form of disordered eating as well, as well as in the binge restrict cycle. So unfortunately it is that fine line between, you know, not under eating, but then typically if you are binging, then you feel so bad about yourself and guilty that you then restrict yourself
more. And
just get caught in this like washing machine of unhealthy behaviors, and it is really hard. You know, anyone that's listening and experiences it, you know, there's no easy quick fix out of it, but the best thing that you can do, I think, is first recognize that you've got those behaviors. Yes, put the steps in place to even talk to a friend about it, seek professional help, because it feels so like helpless when you're in it. But as simple as it sounds, you just sometimes have to, if you have a binge, you just need to get back normal eating the next day, accept that it happened, but don't punish yourself for it, because then otherwise you do get in that cycle again.
I love that. Such great, valuable information. Let's move now to this next chapter. So you've found a nutritionist that really helped you throughout your teen years to understand the impact of food and the impact of our nutrition for our health, got you out of your eating disorder and helped you on that journey. And then you have this mindset shift that, you know what, I want to do this for other people. It's quite a nice thing to discover what you want to do with your life while you're still in high school, while you're still in your teen years. I think a lot of people find it really difficult because they get lost. And I love hearing from people who are like, no, that's what I want to do. So what was that path for you finishing school? Where did you think life was going to go? Where did life go?
Yeah, for sure. And actually, before the whole dietitian thing came up, I thought I'd probably get into physio. So I always thought it was going to be something sports related. But after that thing for myself, I was like, nah, it's nutrition. I think, obviously I went through school. I got into uni. I did uni on the Gold Coast, so Griffith Uni. Griffith Uni. And I did a Bachelor of Nutrition and Dietetics. And the good thing about Griffith is that you can graduate as a dietitian from doing one degree, whereas I know there are a lot of other universities around Australia where you have to do maybe a Bachelor of Nutrition Science and then a Master of Dietetics. So my degree took me 4.5 years. And throughout that time, like I said, initially I was probably more so thinking about going down the eating disorder path, but there was also a massive part of me that always knew I wanted to work in sports. I can only speak for my own degree or my own university studies, but the one that I went through, we had one sports nutrition elective throughout my whole 4.5 years. So in terms of uni, they definitely prepare you to work in a clinical setting. You know, I did 6 months of clinical placement working in hospitals, public health, those types of things. But my passion obviously was more so for the sports side of things. So I think I was fighting this internal battle of, I really want to work in the sports field, but I have no idea how to get there. And then the other part of me is like, well, you've really learned how to become a clinical dietitian. Why don't you just start in the hospital and then you can figure it out from there? So I think I was probably like balancing both of those in terms of like what I really wanted to do versus what I felt like was probably the easier path. And then I guess, long story short, in my third year, I reached out to a company called The Fight Dietitian, who I work for now, because they were doing an internship. And I was like, oh, okay, well, maybe this could be my shot. Like, I've got absolutely no idea about combat sports. I don't do boxing. I don't do Muay Thai. Like, I've never watched the UFC in my life. They probably won't take me, but I'll apply anyway. And I applied for an internship with them. was lucky enough to get it, kind of hung around for a couple of weeks and then hung around for a few months. And then it got to the point where they're like, oh, we'll keep you on. Like you're with us now, like through the rest of your degree and once you graduate type thing. And that was ultimately like the foot in the door to working with athletes and kind of having that dream job that I have now. I still work with, you know, non-athletes as well, people that are just looking to get in shape. But I'd say probably 90% of the people I work with, you know, do some type of sport, which is ultimately where I thought I'd probably have to get to in, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, based on like the traditional pathway of dietetics. But yeah, I was lucky enough to kind of find myself working with athletes as soon as I graduated. And yeah, now I'm in the sports field. So I guess in terms of where I thought I would go versus where I wanted to be, I ended up getting to where I wanted to be. But I guess the path through uni was unclear because I really had no idea how to get there.
That's so interesting. Yeah, because I can imagine the general route for a dietitian is to have the kind of blanket of everybody's nutrition, but then being more specific to athlete, being an athlete yourself, I'm sure was like a dream, but then to land that job and to sort of jump into that unknown of taking an internship, like good on you. It's so cool. And from speaking to Jordan Sullivan, who's, is he the owner, founder of Fight Dietitian? Yeah. Speaking to him, he spoke so highly of you. Also a few of my people who I've been connecting with around my running have mentioned you and your feats as an athlete as well, who are like, you got to speak to Lauren. So it's great to be able to chat to you and talk a bit more about your story before we do get into the dietetics. I mean, before we get into the nutrition for sport, well, it's going to still be talking about nutrition for sport, but I want to talk about your own physical achievements. You recently did an Ironman. You used to be a CrossFitter. You changed over to triathlon. So what made you change? Well, tell me what got you into CrossFit and then what sort of made you change from CrossFit to triathlon?
Yeah. So after skating, I kind of just went to a normal gym for a little bit and, I did a CrossFit challenge at this gym and I thought, oh, this is kind of cool. Like I would love to get into CrossFit, but I'm so scared. And I think anyone that's probably wanted to start CrossFit could resonate with that in terms of CrossFit's very intimidating. You know, you see these women so strong and I'm like, oh my gosh, yeah, I cannot walk into this gym. But, you know, looking back at it, starting CrossFit was another thing that really helped me come out of that eating disorder and that whole body image issue that I had, because CrossFit is what taught me that being strong is actually amazing. Like, you know, eating to fuel my performance and everything. So CrossFit was awesome. I absolutely friggin' loved it. I did it for a couple of years and I did some weightlifting as well. I ultimately, yeah, just got into it because I was quite interested, but also one of my managers at the time through my casual job in high school, she did it and I looked at her and I thought, wow, she's so strong and like powerful. And I think that really helped me to change my internal narrative of not obsessing over skinny, really thin people, but starting to like admire these really strong women. So I think that was like an integral part for myself in terms of like development. And then yeah, did CrossFit for a couple of years. I did a couple of competitions. Like I was never, you know, an RX like top athlete. I just did it for fun, did a couple of team events and stuff. And then through placement, my final year of uni, I started to get a bit interested in triathlon, I suppose. Yeah, I did like a really small kind of little mini triathlon on someone else's bike when I was on placement in this rural town. I don't know if you know where Mount Isa is, but for 3 months I was in the middle of North Queensland, so far away from the beach, and they had a good community up there. And I did my first little triathlon. It was about 42 degrees and that was my first open water swim, and it was traumatizing. There was so much crap in the lake. Oh God, I just like swimming over this, like I think it was called duckweed. It was so gross. And then yeah, just like trying to get a bit into it. And then after uni, I moved to WA and my partner does triathlon. So I feel like that was probably one of the biggest influences to like, you know, kind of take it, see how it goes. Obviously, I work with someone like Geordie who does all these crazy things as well. You know, he's running ultra marathons. Looking up to that as well is quite inspiring. And then, yeah, so kind of started with a couple of sprint triathlons, did an Olympic distance, did 100K. And then I was like, oh, I'm actually like quite enjoying this. And I think at the end of the day, like a big part of why I've continued in this sport is because I work with a lot of endurance athletes, and obviously I can learn a lot from reading a book or just from being a dietitian, but you don't really learn until you're doing it yourself. And I found that it's been an integral part in my practice. And I think as well, you know, it's at the point now where I do the sport because I love it, but also because it makes me a better dietitian for all the people that I work with. And if I kind of relate it back to when I was going through skating and had that eating disorder, I'd already seen two dietitians before I'd met this nutritionist. And the only reason I think that she was able to help me and the other people didn't is because she was a skating coach herself. So she understood what I was going through. She understood my sport. So for me, I know it's, you know, running a marathon isn't a prerequisite to be a dietitian. That is not part of the job. But for me, I work with a lot of people in that space. So I feel like it just helps me to relate to them, understand what it's like to hit the wall, need to go to the toilet 10Ks into a run. So I think a big motivator for me now is probably just trying to be the best dietitian that I can. And then, yeah, did a marathon. Geordie signed me up for it. I had no intentions of ever running a marathon, but I did it. And I was like, oh, wow, like maybe I can do this stuff. And then, yeah, did a half and then just did my first full Ironman. And yeah, it's pretty crazy. You'd understand, I guess, with these types of sports, it's like doing something that's so abnormal. And it's almost hard to wrap your head around thinking, wow, can I exercise for 12 plus hours? Like, that's just crazy.
I know. Thank you so much for sharing that. And that's one of the main reasons why I absolutely love what you and Geordie do and the Fight Dietitian organization is you walk the walk. You're not unrelatable. You're not an unhealthy person there sitting telling people how to be healthy. You guys put yourself through the same challenges that a lot of your athletes go through. That way you can come from a relatable place. You can come from an inspiration place. And you can also come from a place like, I think I remember seeing something recently of Geordie failing a race because of nutrition, to show that, hey, we get this wrong sometimes. Like, don't feel bad if you get stuff wrong. Like, you don't know what's going to happen in your body every single time. Like, impermanence is the greatest thing I've heard about endurance running. You're not going to feel terrible the whole time. You're not going to feel great the whole time, learning that, hey, I'm going to be on a journey this whole way. And the fact that you have both been on these journeys of endurance athlete endeavors is so cool. Let's talk about one of them though, because an Ironman is something that, I mean, my 100K, I'm probably going to be exercising for longer, but it's different beast. You said you've done 100K as well. So maybe we'll go to that first. Have you done 100K, did you say? Run?
I've done a 100K triathlon. It's like distance, kind of not quite a half, but it's like longer than an Olympic distance. So no, I haven't ran 100K.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the Ironman that you've just recently completed, because it's hard to do stuff justice sometimes. Just the word marathon compared to the word Ironman. Hey, there's pretty much maybe the same amount of letters in them. It's just like, they just don't seem like, oh, they're both a big challenge.
Yeah.
And Ironman is like 9 hours more or 8 hours more of work than a marathon. Do you want to explain to the listeners? I'm sure there is a few that understand what, and even like people go, oh, a triathlon compared to an Ironman. How much different could it be? Like, it is bloody different. A triathlon to then a half Ironman to then an Ironman is just like a whole different beast. So can you explain to me what a full Ironman is? Because yeah, I'm trying to get James Lawrence, you know, the Iron Cowboy.
Yep.
I've been trying to get him on the podcast. We've been on email and DMs a bit, but him doing 50 in a row, or 100 in a row, 100 days in a row is ridiculous. But tell me about your one, the one that you did recently, and what the training looked like for you, how much prep, how long that prep was, and then talk me through race day.
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, for anyone that doesn't know what an Ironman is, it's a 3.8 kilometer open water swim, a 180K bike ride, and then a full marathon. So 42.2 Ks of running. We were talking off air and you said, how do you feel when you get off the bike and you've got to run a marathon? And like, obviously that's just a messed up thought. But for me, you know, I'd say when it comes to my preferences in triathlon, I really only enjoy the running. So I knew once I hopped off that bike, I was going to make it, because I was most worried about the bike. But yeah, I guess in terms of training, I pretty much did about a 3-month Ironman focus. I had a half Ironman on the, I think it was the 3rd of December last year. And then the Ironman was on the 2nd of March. So I did a small build into the half Ironman. Didn't really have that as an A race. It was kind of just like a preparation then for the March event. And then, yeah, it was pretty much a 3 months or 12 week focused Ironman block. During the peak weeks, I think we probably had about four like peak weeks. Training was about 20 to 25 hours a week. So I was pretty much doing 3 swims, 3 bikes, 3 runs, a brick session. One of those was a brick session. So like ride and run, and then 2 to 3 strength sessions a week as well. So I did have one rest day, but every other day it was pretty much get up early, train, work all day, train late at night, and then repeat. The weekends were getting to the point where going for 6.5 hour bike rides and then sometimes having to get off and going for a 30 to 60 minute run. So it kind of just got to the point during training where I had absolutely no mental capacity to catch up with friends afterwards, because early on I tried to still maintain like a little bit of social balance and training. But when you're waking up at, you know, I don't know, 3 a.m. on a Saturday, you're riding your bike for 6 hours and then, you know, you've got to go and have dinner with a friend, you just have absolutely nothing left to give. And I think something that I need to make very clear is if you've got a 6 hour ride programmed, it's not just 6 hours, because by the time you maybe have a flat, you've got to fill up your water bottles, you stop to go to the toilet, you're probably out there for about 7 hours. So they were just some very, very long days.
And then you have to wake up a bit early to fuel your body, which I'd love to talk to you about. You also have to pencil in that you need to make sure you're eating straight after. So yeah, tell me what throughout your training block, what role nutrition played throughout your training block.
Yeah, definitely. Obviously, being a dietitian, I feel like nutrition was probably one of the most important things for me, but also just second nature, I guess. I'm not discrediting my athletic abilities by saying this, but I genuinely think that I probably couldn't have done an Ironman this soon in my own triathlon, I guess, career, so to speak, if it wasn't for my nutrition, because I haven't been doing endurance sport for that long. And an Ironman is a big thing. But I think because I obviously know what I'm doing with my nutrition, that played a huge role in it. Because for the normal person, eating while you're running or eating while you're on the bike, that's just so abnormal. Whereas for me, it just seemed like super normal. So while I can be pretty blasé with my own nutrition compared to the same like my clients, I do try to be pretty strict. Obviously, before every single session, I was getting up, like you said, early. I'd get up half an hour early before my events, my training session. Sorry, I'd make sure I got enough food in. Even if I trained for like 60 minutes, I'd probably take a gel with me. Like anything over 90 minutes, I was kind of emulating what I would do on the race day. Pretty much, my life just revolved around working, eating, and training. Honestly, and
like sleeping.
Sleeping, yeah. I think that's probably how it worked. But yeah, I guess, like I said, you know, I'm not super strict on myself sometimes, but then I remind myself, like, Lauren, you tell people to do X, Y, and Z, and you get annoyed if they don't do it. So you've kind of got to put that same, I guess, standard to yourself. And I think that's a big motivator to me as well, because I work with a lot of, you know, ultra runners, Ironman athletes. And I think like they're listening to me and they're putting this information, you know, into practice. Like I need to not slack off with myself, because I would feel it. I do remember there was this one weekend and I had a massive ride and run and I just felt absolutely wiped. And I was just thinking, like, what is going on here? And I had to pause and reflect, and I was like, okay, I actually probably haven't been eating enough. So I think there was a bit of reflection as well in terms of, you know, we don't always get it right, like you said with Jordy, you know, just because it's our job doesn't mean we're experts all the time, and it can be really easy to slip off. But you definitely notice it when you're training as much as like you would be at the moment as well. If you can't really sleep a lot, if you're getting, you know, up early, going to bed late, obviously nutrition plays an even more important role in terms of like developing, I guess, our energy levels and recovering so that you can train twice a day. So yeah, I think I did pretty well with my nutrition, if I'm being honest.
What are some key principles for an endurance athlete to follow during a training block? Like what food groups should we be aiming to get? And let's talk in the context of, okay, we're burning, I don't know, like for instance, I did a 20K run a few days ago and it's like a 2000 active calorie, or like a 30K run, 2000 active calories. What are some key principles to try and follow, like proteins, carbs, what food groups should we be doing before training, after training? Just a couple little, I guess, baseline stuff that people who are training quite a bit during a week should be following.
For sure. And I think like you kind of alluded to earlier, everyone's going to have very different training loads. But I think something that everyone needs to realize is they definitely need to make best friends with carbohydrates. I think there's a lot of misinformation out there about carbs, and especially in the endurance scene, there's also quite a bit of, I guess, not necessarily misinformation, but a lot of strong opinions about low carb, high fat and ketones and all these types of things. But above all else, I think people just really need to accept that carbohydrates are king, and your diet should probably be 50% carbohydrates. Obviously everyone's going to have their different kind of like calorie split, right? But say you're able to work out, you know, your total daily energy requirements, I would say 50% of that should be coming from carbohydrates. And then you could probably go say like 20% protein, 30% fat. And I say that because again, fat is super important, because there's a lot of research that comes out that if you're eating like less than 20% of your daily intake from fat, so things like avocado, salmon, nuts, you're actually at risk of obviously hormone imbalances and nutrient deficiencies as well. So I think people probably get in the a habit maybe of like favoring one nutrient over another. But when it comes to like the ultimate endurance diet, it's not being vegan, it's not being gluten-free, it's not being keto. I genuinely think it's having like a pretty even split of carbohydrates, protein, and fat. And the biggest thing you could do, like if I could talk about nutrition for days, but if I had to just give one tip, like probably the most simple tip anyone could do to improve their training, it's eating before training. Like I don't care if people say, I can't eat before training, like I feel sick. I think I used to be embarrassed to like maybe stand up to them, or, you know, I'd be like, oh, it's okay, like if you feel sick. But I'm kind of at the point now where there's really no excuse for someone to not be able to eat before training. And I think if you are one of those people and you're listening and you're like, no, like, what are you talking about? I can't eat before training. Either one, you're not eating the right types of foods, or two, you're not giving yourself enough time. And, you know, you alluded to it before, like having to wake up earlier to eat. And I understand we all love sleep, but at the end of the day, if you can just even wake up 15 minutes earlier and get even one Majul date or something, you're going to kind of set yourself up and just start implementing a habit that's going to help you in the long term. So I think for anyone that does, for like anyone that does struggle, I guess, to like eat before you work out, I would just say like start super simple and start super small. Like even if it's half a banana, or it's one rice cake with honey, or maybe it's like two slices of dried mango, it doesn't need to be, you know, a 3-course meal at 4 a.m. in the morning. You just need to start exposing your gut to carbohydrates, because we talk a lot about training your gut, and you obviously put a lot of time into doing the physical training, right? So our stomach is no different. And the more that you expose your body to food before training, over time, it's going to get a lot more comfortable and a lot more used to digesting it. So I think start 60 minutes before. And if you, you know, persist with it and you're eating consistently, you'll get to the point where I am, where I could probably eat, you know, a banana and honey on rice cakes, and then 5 minutes later I'm out running. So start back further, and then obviously over time just increase that comfortability, because if you're running an ultra like you are, Cooper, obviously you're going to get to the point where you're eating while you're running. So your body has to be able to digest and process food while you're running. So you need to start with that before you even start training. So like helping your body to be able to exercise whilst digesting food ultimately.
I love that. First and foremost, I learn a lot there. I'm an absolute sucker for just getting up, having a bit of water, and going and doing my 10 or 20K run in the morning and having some fuel. So no excuses for me. I'm going to start eating. Let's dumb it right back. You mentioned a few foods there, a date, a banana.
Yeah.
Where do we get carbohydrates from? I'm someone who kind of has a bit of an understanding, and I still get confused when we go carbohydrates, proteins, fats. Do you just want to quickly break down, like, give me a handful of different simple early morning foods that which you already kind of have? Because I think of carbs and I think of like pasta, rice, which I'm probably wrong anyway. So I think of pasta, rice, toast, like just getting those sort of carbs in. But you said dried mango, all this other stuff. So when we're thinking carbohydrates, what are some food groups that we should be looking to get in?
For sure. And you're 100% right. Pasta, rice, toast, potato, they all fit into the carbohydrate category. I guess there may be just some things like pasta or rice you're not going to want to eat at 4 a.m.
Yeah, of course.
So yeah, other options could be things like oats, Weet-Bix, cereal, dried fruit or fresh fruit. When it comes to fresh fruit, I'd probably say go for certain types. So say, for example, if we compare an apple and a banana, an apple has a lot more fiber. So that apple is going to be a little bit slower to digest before you train. And when we are talking about pre-training nutrition, we want to go for lower fiber things. So in that example, a banana is going to be a lot better because it's a lot lower in fiber. It's going to digest easier. So yeah, dried fruit are good. Any kind of snack bars. So even, you know, a simple like Uncle Toby's oat bar, Cliff bar, Rice Krispie bars, all of those, you know, Morton solid bars, anything like that is perfect as well. Probably, you know, get a lot of like, oh, when I say this, but even lollies are a really good option. If you really struggle and you don't have much time, you know, whack down to, you know, natural confectionery snakes or something. Those types of things are what you want to be going for. Pikelets, bagels with jam or honey. I think, yeah, they're probably the types of things that you should be having. And I think this is maybe where people get it wrong, because they view these foods as like, oh, I shouldn't be starting my day with, you know, a piece of toast and honey on it. That's so bad for you. But it then kind of brings in another argument that we see a lot in the nutrition space, and that's kind of the whole processed versus unprocessed food group. And, you know, people might be listening like, I can't believe she's a dietitian and she's telling people to have lollies. But there's a time and place for these types of foods in terms of you ultimately want to be going for the food that your body's going to be able to digest and break down in the easiest way possible. I think everyone can use their common sense and know that an avocado is a lot healthier than some lollies. But in the context of pre-training nutrition, an avocado is probably going to give you runner's gut or some sort of stomach upset because it's high in fat, it's high in fiber, and it's going to take a long time to digest. Whereas the lolly snakes have no protein, no fiber, no fat. They're all carbohydrates. Our body's going to digest them, absorb them super fast so that our body has energy to exercise.
And then we're going to burn it off anyway, right? Yeah, I'm very excited for my can of Coke and Krispy Kreme donut at 50Ks. That's what I've just said. Just get the 50 in. You can have that because you've earned it, which I think is great. So thank you for talking about that. We're going to quickly talk about your Ironman in New Zealand, and then we're going to do a little bit of a chat about my 100K, what sort of planning I should be doing and pre-training or like pre-race preparation, like gels during runs, how often I should be drinking. And I want to talk to you about hydration too. There's a lot of things I want to talk to you about, but let's talk about your Ironman recently, New Zealand, correct?
Yeah. Yep. So I did the Ironman over in Taupo in New Zealand. It was awesome. It was pretty challenging conditions on the day. We had a hectic headwind on the bike. I am so embarrassed with this, but I was going up the hill back into town and I remember looking at my bike computer and it said it's 7 kilometers an hour. And I was like, oh my God, like I should just get off and walk. That was like pretty demoralizing. Like the winds are pretty awful. But to be honest, other than the weather, I had an awesome experience. And from a nutrition perspective, I was mentally prepared for something to go wrong in terms of like I had a good plan. I'd set up a plan for myself. I'd trialed it in training, but just based on, you know, all the clients I work with and all the horror stories that you hear about endurance events, I was just waiting. You know, I was like, okay, I've got this plan, but I'm probably going to feel sick at some point. I'm going to get sick of my gels. Like I'm going to need to run to the Portaloos at the aid station. So I was in no way going in thinking that it was going to be, you know, a walk in the park. But I'm actually so happy to say that I don't think my nutrition could have gone any better. I didn't have any gut issues. I did go to the toilet once because I really needed to pee, but I didn't have any gut upset. I didn't bonk at all. I had a pretty stable energy level throughout. So I think in reflection, like I was pretty happy with how I did my nutrition. And I can like go through it briefly if you want.
I'd love to. Do you want to talk me through what your nutrition on the day looked like, what you ate before you started the race that morning, maybe what you ate the night before? Because we hear quite often like should be carb loading before long distance stuff, like you'd hear that all the time. So yeah, do you want to tell me sort of what you ate the night before, morning of, and then throughout that day? And then as well, the recovery is something that maybe we'll touch on just after when we talk about my preparation. But yeah, do you want to talk me through that?
Yeah, sure. So yeah, the 2 days before, and we'll kind of talk about this because I'd encourage the same for you, but yeah, I did a carbohydrate load. So I had around 10 grams of carbs per kilogram of my body weight. That's ultimately what I was aiming for the 2 days before I raced. And that's what I'd encourage you or anyone listening to do as well before a big event. It's just such an easy way to kind of prime your body for what's to come. So I think my go-to kind of dinner before a triathlon is just like white pasta, like a red sauce, a little bit of chicken breast and some cheese, because you get a little bit of protein and then you get a lot of salt from the sauce, and then you get obviously a heap of carbohydrates from the pasta. So that's kind of been my go-to meal before like any triathlon recently. And then in the morning of, I got up, I think I had my breakfast about 2 hours before. So I've got celiac disease. So I have gluten-free Weet-Bix, with some banana, maple syrup, soy milk. Like that's kind of my go-to. And then when I was getting ready for the swim, I had a little bag of lollies and I had a couple of lollies just as like a primer. Obviously did the swim, got out, was so grateful that I survived, got into transition. And like while I was getting ready to hop on the bike, I just grabbed like a little, well, you know, those little energy street waffles. Have you seen those?
I haven't, but actually someone told me about these recently.
Yeah. So I just had one of those in transition. I just quickly like chugged it down like while I was going to run for my bike and washed it down with like a cup of electrolytes. And then yeah, hopped on the bike, and pretty much for the bike I was averaging I think maybe about a 700 ml bottle of carbohydrate electrolyte drink mix an hour and a sleeve of energy chews. I also threw in I think maybe like 2 caffeinated Morton gels just because
every hour.
No, not every hour for the Morton gels. I think I just had 2 over the course of the race. They were just randoms that I didn't necessarily factor into the plan, but I just felt like when I went past the aid station, so I just grabbed one. So I think I was probably hitting around 85 to 90 grams of carbs an hour on the bike. And then, yeah, hopped off the bike. I did tell myself that I was going to do another street waffle in transition, but I felt pretty good from the bike. So I put it in my back pocket and I ran out. And then once I was like 10 minutes into the run, have you done a triathlon before?
I've done a Olympic triathlon, like a two hour one down in Byron.
Nice. Did you, when you came out of T2, was your heart rate like absolutely through the roof, like coming off the bike into the run?
Yeah, that's why I said it's so gnarly getting off and putting your shoes on. I only had to run 10Ks, and by that last few Ks, I was just like battling.
Yeah. So yeah, that feeling is like when you, that's always the worst part for me is like T2 is like your heart rate is just so high because you come out so hot on the run and you're like, look at your watch and you're like, whoa, I need to like bring this back. So once I'd actually settled into the run, I started with my run nutrition and I was pretty much going for one Morton gel, I think every 30-ish minutes. And yeah, probably I stopped every single aid, or not necessarily stopped, but I got a full cup of electrolytes every single aid station. So that's kind of how I did it for the run. I did, yeah, a gel every 20 to 30 minutes.
So no solids?
No. I had the little waffle and then on the bike, I had the chews. So they were, I guess for me, I classify those as solids as opposed to like the gels and the liquids. But yeah, I didn't have any kind of like bananas or sandwiches or anything for me. I do find for me though, personally, because I've got celiac disease, gluten-free bread is like not great. And I feel like I do have a lot less options than, you know, anyone that doesn't have to worry about it. So for me, I do probably have to preference things like chews or gels and things. And that's fine because like I know how my body works. But in the past, I've done gels on the bike. And I learned in my half Ironman last year that for something this long, I could not just do all gels. So that's why I really tried to kind of put off the gels until the run. And yeah, I was able to stomach them for the entire run. I actually couldn't wait to have my next gel. So they were all going down really nicely. And then I think from the third lap, because the New Zealand course, it's like a 4-lap run course. From the third lap, I started drinking Coke at the aid stations and that was pretty good as well.
Good. That's so interesting. The whole carbohydrate water is something I haven't tried yet. I actually have to go to Wild Earth, the store. Actually, they're sponsoring me to do this run, which is really cool. So I can see you smiling. I'm sure you've been into Wild Earth before, maybe. And I'm about to go pick up some carbohydrate water, which I'd never even, this is how like new I am to this sport. I just thought like you're electrolyte water or water. I didn't realize that you like have carb water, so it's like you're getting in those calories through the water as well. Is that basically what carb water is?
Yeah, definitely. And it's such a good way to go about it as well, because I can't speak for you personally, but most people find it easier to drink than eat while they're running.
I do, definitely.
So if you can get your carbohydrates and your electrolytes and your fluid in at one go, it's just such an efficient way to fuel. And I think generally works well for a lot of people, especially with ultra running, because obviously you've got a lot more motion in the stomach, whereas on the bike, right, your stomach's not churning around as much. But for running, yeah, if you can get the carb drink mix in, that would be great. Do you know what you're picking up, or do you get to kind of choose?
I'm picking up one, and it's like mango iced tea flavor. It looked really nice. It's what brand is it? I can't remember what brand it is. Give me like 2 seconds, I'll find it. But with what about when you finish the race? What is post race nutrition, and then probably more so like training nutrition post each workout? Like, what should my protocol be post a session that's, I guess, more than an hour?
Yeah, for sure. I think for me personally with the race, I pretty much ran straight into the recovery tent. I think I downed like 5 cups of chocolate milk. That was kind of like my go-to. But when it comes to like after training, what you'd want to go for, like just as like a guideline, would probably say go about 1 gram of carbohydrates per kilogram of your body weight. So whatever that is, just multiply it by 1. And then for protein, probably go anywhere from like 25 to 40 grams of protein. Like that's going to be a pretty blanket statement that most people would get a benefit.
That's what I mean. I hear these beautiful statements of weighing and I'm like, I'm going to be completely honest. I cannot see myself like weighing my food and going like to the gram. Like what... This is like bad, but for me, like when I finish my runs, I'm like, all right, protein shake, get everything in that shake so I can get it done. So like, I put like 2 spoons of protein in. I'll then do a spoon of like super greens. I'll then do like a few bananas, some strawberries, blueberries, full cream milk, bit of honey, bit of peanut butter. I'm one of those people that just chucks everything in there.
That sounds absolutely perfect. That sounds like you're ticking all the boxes. And that's the thing, you can be super scientific about it. I don't I don't even personally, I don't track my macros. I don't track my calories. That probably stems from my past. Like, I don't really want to obsess about that. I know what I should be eating.
And how you feel. Yeah.
And yeah, it's like, you don't need to kind of, you know, specifically track, oh, am I getting 30 grams of protein? But what you just did is perfect. Like, as long as you're not just doing, like, a lot of people love to finish and they just make a protein shake. But the best way that you can recover from training is actually having carbohydrates with that protein shake. So like, you put the protein in, but you put bananas in as well. You've got milk in there. I think as long as you don't forget about carbohydrates in the recovery window, that is the most important thing. Cause I think, you know,
more so than protein.
Well, not necessarily more so, but like together they work really well. It's because, you know, like gym bro workout, it'll just be like protein powder and like, yep, all good. But with endurance athletes, one of the aims of recovery nutrition is actually restoring your muscle glycogen stores, which you probably just depleted during your training session. So in order to do that, we need protein and carbohydrates, and they actually work really well together in terms of helping your body to restore muscle glycogen levels. And if you've got another training session later in the day or the next day, it's super important that you do that as quickly as possible. So if you could have that smoothie that you're having, or like, I guess another example is even like, maybe if you're really in a rush, you could just quickly make a protein shake and like have a banana and a Clif bar with it as well. Like, it doesn't need to be anything fancy, but as long as you're not neglecting the carbs after training, that's super important for endurance athletes.
I love that. I didn't know that too much. I just kind of see that as like, you got to replace the calories that you're obviously burning, like with so much activity and high heart rate, we're burning so many calories. Let's talk about my run now. So 100-kilometer run is something that it's going to be a big challenge. I just like laugh at it every time I say it out loud. And it's something that I'm not at all versed in. I'm not a runner at all. I've come from I guess, explosive sport background, like surfing. Why? I hear a lot of people talking about endurance running, training your gut is so important, pre-training your gut. Why is that important?
For sure. So I think with training your gut, like I said, you know, you put a lot of time into doing the physical training, making sure your muscles and your heart are conditioned for this exercise. But ultimately, when you're exercising, your body diverts blood flow away from your gastrointestinal tract to the muscles, because they're the things that are working the most. So when it comes to fueling during training, your gut is quite sensitive and there's obviously not a lot of blood flow there. So over time, we need to be able to train our stomach ultimately to be able to cope with, to digest, to absorb nutrients while we have that limited blood flow during exercise. So when it comes to training your gut, we're not talking about going from having no carbohydrates per hour to then trying to push 90 grams. It's just very incremental changes. So say, for example, you're someone that consistently goes for 2-hour runs. If you don't currently fuel, I don't want you to go out and smash 3 cans of Coke and 2 Clif bars, because that's what is going to cause you to feel sick. But what you can do is, you know, the first week, maybe you can just take one gel and just have that one gel over the course of the entire 2-hour run. And then the next week, we're going to increase that to 2 gels. And then the next week, you know, maybe it's like one gel and one bottle of Tailwind, which is a really popular carb electrolyte drink mix. So I think
that's the one that I was just about. Yeah, I've got Trail Brew.
Perfect. Yeah. That's a really good option as well. It's just about kind of think about it as progressive overload for your stomach. Because when you're training, right, you're building up your physical conditioning. It's the same with your stomach as well. You want to kind of start small and just introduce additional volumes of food as you go. And the easiest way that you can train your gut is doing what I mentioned before, kind of with the avocado and the lolly snake example. You just want to be keeping it as simple as possible. You just want to be getting carbs, obviously some liquids and some electrolytes. You don't need to be having yet fat or protein shakes during runs. We just want to keep it super simple. And ultimately, you've got to think about that end goal. So for you, it's a 100-kilometer race. You want to be able to get through that with as little stomach problems as you can. So, you know, while you're putting in the physical work, doing all of your training, you also need to give a bit of time to your nutrition as well.
Yeah, I love that. It's something that I'm just really now, I'm like, 6 weeks out now, 7 weeks out, starting to get into my long runs that are that sort of 3-4 hours. So I'm like learning, okay, I really need to start doing my nutrition. The last couple, like 25 Ks, I've been having like 2 Morton gels, like sort of one every 40 minutes to start getting used to that. I've been having some dates as well, sort of throughout my runs, been drinking like just a hydration, having like 2 flasks, 1 hydration, 1 straight water, and been feeling pretty good, but I haven't really now ticked over that 3-4 hour mark, where that's where I feel like when I did my marathon, I'd run a marathon on no training a couple of years ago, which bad idea, but I hit that 3 hour mark and I just like hit this wall of like, oh my God, my body's cooked. And I think it was because my nutrition had just run out. So what is that? What happens there in our bodies if we don't fuel it right? What are the consequences of underfueling as an endurance athlete?
Yeah. So if we think about it just specifically during a session and then just in every day, we'll break it into those two categories because cool. I think it's important for people to understand both. If you're underfueling in like an individual session, ultimately, if your body doesn't have enough, I guess, external carbohydrates on board, it'll start tapping into our internal stores, which is our muscle glycogen. And ultimately, that's what causes fatigue, bonking, potentially cramping, those types of things, because our body is having to work a little bit harder to actually break down energy that our body has stored away. Whereas if we've just had some food or you're putting in the gels during your run, those carbohydrates are more available to the body to use because they're just kind of floating around as opposed to these other forms of carbohydrates that are tightly packed away as you're kind of, I guess, what is it like if you know, there's a natural disaster coming and you've kind of
reserve stores.
Yeah, reserve stores. So kind of think of your muscle glycogen as like your reserve stores. And there's a lot of energy there, but your body does have to work a little bit harder to break it down. And over time, if you start to really deplete those stores, that's what causes you to hit that wall at 3 hours. So I think if you're not adequately fueling within your session, you're going to have increased RPE. Your heart rate's potentially going to be a little bit higher. You're at risk of fatigue, obviously. Muscle cramps can sometimes come on as well. So I think within session, yeah, if you've got that low energy, it's feeling a lot harder than normal, it's probably a good sign that you haven't fueled enough. But if we kind of extend that to like the everyday, I think these are all going to sound like just symptoms of just generally being tired, which is kind of the danger and why people can't, I guess, identify it. But there's this condition called low energy availability. And a lot of endurance athletes are at risk because you've got really high training loads. You might not know how to properly refuel. So if you're consistently obviously feeling really tired, maybe you've got recurring injuries or sickness, and or it's taking you a long time to recover from those things. If you're disinterested in your training, you're plateauing, you're not necessarily progressing, you've got decreased sex drive, or for women, you've noticed changes to your menstrual cycle. All of those things are a really big red flag that your body's saying, hey, you're not giving me enough energy for how much training you're asking me to do. And obviously these can all be symptoms of other things, but if you notice them persistently happening, it's a really good sign that you need to probably check in with how much you're eating, because low energy availability can obviously impact your training, yes, but it can also impact your everyday health as well. And specifically for females, in terms of the whole menstrual cycle thing, it's very common for endurance female athletes to lose their period or to miss a period, but it's not normal at all. So in women, it's quite obvious, whereas for men, it's looking out for things like decreased sex drive, because overtraining can impact our hormones as well.
Interesting. Thank you. I think that's a great breakdown to understand why we've got to make sure we're getting enough fuel in. And it's, to be honest, there's a few of those red flags that I feel like I need to be aware of, this idea of like feeling somewhat always tired, and I put it down to, oh, because I'm so busy with work and juggling everything. But I know my nutrition's bad. I've got like such a weird, like I seem to be able to function fine with minimal eating. It's weird. I can like have a coffee in the morning, go do my workout, get back, have a protein shake, not really be hungry for the rest of the day, have like a late 3 o'clock lunch, and then not be hungry for dinner and have a piece of toast with peanut butter. And like, that was my day yesterday, for instance. And I did like a 12K run in the morning and another bit of physical activity. So it's like, I'm probably under fueling, I think, for what I'm taking on. So I need to start being a bit more cautious of that and a bit more aware of that, which I think is important. Two more things that I want to chat to you about. The first one is supplementation. What's your take on supplementation? And this, once again, I know this is a very specific for each person kind of thing, but for me, like, I look at like taking my like greens, I have just like a organic greens mix just from the chemist, whatever. My psychology of that is like, okay, I know I probably don't eat enough fruit and vegetables. If I smash that in my shake, at least I'm getting those vitamins and minerals. What other, like, another one, I did my blood tests recently and I had a guy look over and he's like, you should be taking like a B12 spray, you should be taking, what else did he say I should be taking? Beef liver. He told me to take, what else? Iron. Just a couple of things. What are some supplements that are pretty generic as someone who does work with a lot of clients and don't take this as medical advice, anyone listening right now, but what are some things to look out for and some supplements that most of us should look at, getting into our diet?
Yeah, for sure. And I think with supplements as well, it's kind of important to remember that like supplements are called supplements for a reason. Yeah. And that's the supplement, like a solid diet, not to necessarily replace things that are lacking. However, if we're talking about endurance athletes specifically, you're going to have a very high training load, which means you're probably going to have heightened requirements from the everyday person anyway.
Exactly.
So I think if we use you as an example, you had a blood test done and obviously someone had gone over it and noticed a couple of deficiencies. So I always think if you're thinking about taking supplements, the best place to start is going and just getting a blood test because too much of a good thing can be a bad thing. And I see this with women specifically. Girls say that they're taking an iron tablet and I'm like, oh, you know, have you had iron deficiency? And they say, oh, no, I just take it. But having too much iron is actually incredibly problematic. It can lead to its own health implications. So I think first things first, if you're thinking that you've got quite low energy, you're quite fatigued, go and get a blood test. I get all my athletes to get a blood test before we start working together so that we can assess for nutrient deficiencies. In your instance as well, things like vitamin B and iron, they're two of the biggest ones that you probably do need to be aware of for an endurance athlete. Like you said, this isn't medical advice. If you do have a known deficiency, I think that you definitely need to be taking those types of things. However, a lot of people can probably just benefit from taking a multi-daily vitamin just because it's going to give you very small amounts of all different nutrients and just to help you keep at baseline at least because you're probably going to have heightened requirements. So sometimes just taking a daily multivitamin can be a good place to start. Otherwise, in terms of supplements, ultimately for things like, you know, greens powders, of course, the best way to get it in is from your diet because with like whole fruits, you do get the fiber concept, but again, it's come from a place of awareness in your example where, you know what, I probably don't quite eat enough, you know, maybe I've got a chaotic lifestyle, I don't always eat the best meals. So that's a great way to kind of foolproof and just make sure that you are still getting those nutrients in. When it comes to other supplements though, obviously endurance sport, like a big part of it is the gels, it's the carbohydrate drink mixes, it's the energy chews and the bars. So I guess those types of supplements, they have a very strong role in endurance sport. But in terms of other supplements, one of the only other ones that most of my athletes would take or I would encourage is actually a magnesium supplement. It's not a be all and end all, but I do find that it seems to be pretty effective in kind of managing those restless legs, preventing muscle cramps during the night and helping you to have a better quality sleep. So I probably take a pretty simple approach with supplements for my endurance athletes, but typically it could be a multivitamin, obviously an iron tablet if they've got an identified nutrient deficiency. Otherwise, magnesium is really one of the only other ones I probably recommend.
Yeah, I need to get back onto my magnesium. Magnesium is such an important one. Another thing I'd love to chat to you about, let's talk processed foods compared to organic and non-organic foods. I'm not even going to say conspiracy theorist. I put it down to intuitively. Intuition for me makes me go, do I want to eat something that's been genetically modified by a fucking scientist? Or do I want to eat something that has made humans survive for the last thousands and thousands of years without us having to fuck with it? And it's very hard to get fruit and veg and meat that's organic nowadays anyway. But from a nutrition and dietitian point of view, how much should we be trying to eat organic compared to non-organic? And then like I'm very big on very, very rarely eating processed stuff. I absolutely do. Don't get me wrong. I'll eat a bag of chips and stuff every now and then. But I try my best to eat whole foods and whatnot. So can we just have a quick conversation about that and your experience or your recommendations around organic compared to non-organic? Because I know it's hard, it's more expensive, it's difficult, but I just go to the farmers markets each week. I think it's once again intuitively a better interaction chatting to someone about the food that they've grown that you're going to eat and fuel your body. I sit there and do intention setting and gratitude for my food before I eat it, and whether you're into that sort of stuff or not, I think it really works for me. It's all energy transfer.
Yeah, definitely. And I think you've kind of said it perfectly yourself when it comes to the whole argument of organic versus non-organic foods. I think firstly, it probably comes down to the reality for many people, which is what's achievable for you. Obviously, someone that's feeding a family of six probably can't quite justify an organic shop. And they shouldn't feel guilty or feel bad because of that as well. Because then if we look at it from a nutrition perspective, there's absolutely no difference from a nutritional perspective in terms of like you know, calories or macros or micronutrient breakdowns, potentially something's going to be fresher than the other product. But from a nutrition perspective, it doesn't really change the fact if it's organic or non-organic. So I think the whole idea with that is obviously, yes, the reality is certain products are going to be exposed to less pesticides and those types of things. But I think when it comes to organic versus non-organic, it's more of like a personal approach in terms of what sits best with your ethics and your beliefs. Because like you said, it does have an impact in the way that you view food. So that's probably with regards to that, you know, I would never make people say, okay, well, we're working together, you can only buy organic foods, because that's a huge barrier for many people. For myself, even I probably don't always buy organic food because I just buy like whatever's at the supermarket or whatever's at the local markets type of thing. So I think in terms of organic versus non-organic, if we look at it from a personal perspective, I think that is very individual and you should go with whatever option makes you feel better, because that's what's going to have the biggest impact. But from a nutrition perspective, there's no difference in terms of organic versus non-organic in terms of the macro and micronutrients that that product is going to be giving you. And then if we look at it, the whole foods versus the processed foods, I think this is a big debate for us anyway. We always get asked, you know, like, I shouldn't be eating processed food, or you shouldn't be encouraging processed food for your athletes, like that's so unhealthy. But the unfortunate reality is if we actually look at the definition of processed foods, you know, even the corn that was harvested at your farm has undergone some level of processing, right? Because processing is ultimately like any kind of procedure that's happened to get that food from there to you. Milk or our eggs, they've all had some degree of processing. But I understand most people talk about it in the context of, let's say, like a banana versus, you know, a packet of chips. And when it comes to like our everyday diet, we should 100% be aiming to have a whole foods-based diet. So all of our meals, our snacks, if we can be getting our nutrients from fresh fruit and veg, you know, grains like rice and quinoa, fresh made breads, like proteins if you eat animal products, if not, you know, going things like tofu and tempeh and all of those types of things. So the basis of a healthy diet should definitely be whole foods focused. That is where you're going to get the most nutrients and the highest quality in your diet. But when we bring it back to endurance athletes, the reality is that you cannot sustain, I guess, say 100 kilometer event on only eating potatoes or only eating avocados. So there is a time and a place for processed foods. And I think, again, we don't have to eat lollies. It could be like a dried fruit, which is, yes, still processed, but potentially a little bit more natural. Because at the end of the day, these are the types of foods that your body is going to digest, break down and absorb really quickly. It's not going to leave you feeling sick or having any gastrointestinal issues. So when it comes to processed foods, I think it's important for, say, 90% of your diet to be made up of whole foods, so your main meals. But if you're just getting up quickly to go for a run before training, you shouldn't feel guilty for potentially just grabbing a Clif Bar on the way out the door, because that's what's going to kind of get the job done. And another reality as well, like you might find this yourself, you're obviously burning a lot of calories, right? And it can be quite hard to physically eat that much food. That's what we see with a lot of our athletes. So sometimes it might be as simple as, you know, potentially like having a chocolate milk here and there, or adding some Nutella to your sandwich, because those are the ways that we can actually really increase calorie requirements.
Yeah.
I know it probably sounds like a first world problem, like, oh, I can't eat enough calories, but that's the reality for a lot of people. They really struggle to eat enough food to fuel their body. And again, this is where processed foods can help us. So the diet shouldn't be 100% processed, but there is a time and a place, and I don't think that they should be frowned upon.
Hey, I love that. I think it's a good update for people. I just see like processed foods, like stuff that I was like pumped with preservatives to have shelf life. Like I said, it comes back to just like my personal intuition, but it's good to know that it's not the end of the world for everyone else out there and me as well when we have to eat processed foods. The last thing I want to talk about is probably the most important of all, hydration. Mm-hmm. Hydration, what should be my hydration, somewhat, I guess, tactic maybe with training, but also with specifically more so the race day? What should I be looking, how much should I be trying to put through myself? Because obviously we're sweating, we're losing our salts, we're losing more than just water. That's why it's important to have electrolytes. Just want to talk to me about the importance of hydration.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess if we're talking about yourself as well, like, could you give me a quick overview of maybe what you're currently doing with your hydration?
Yeah, of course. As in day to day or more so with my training runs?
Maybe more so with your training.
Okay, perfect. So with my training, if I'm like running now I'll give you my like long runs. So my long runs, I've been doing like 2 to 3 hours the last couple of weeks. I'll take like 2 500 ml flasks in my vest, with one with a hydration thing, like a Hydrolite, couple tabs in it, water. And then the other thing, I'll just have water. And that's kind of been me up to like an hour and a half. And then I'll sort of try refill after hour and a half, 2 hours.
Awesome. Well, yeah, I think you're already on a good track. And I think the best way to go about hydration is it's very individual because we all have different sweat rates. So someone that loses maybe like a liter of fluid an hour versus someone that loses 400 mils, they're both going to have very different you know, trajectories in terms of their run. But the biggest piece of advice that I could probably give you is this is just like an exercise that you can do in training, and this will help give us a really good baseline of like how much you should be consuming. So I'm not sure if you've done this before, but on your next long run, weigh yourself before your training session. Just take note of like how much you're drinking during, and then weigh yourself after that training session, and just try and calculate the difference in weight, if there is any, and then divide that by how many hours you exercise for. And now that's going to give you a guideline. Let's just say, for example, it comes back that you've half a kilo an hour. So ultimately, yes, you're going to be burning, you know, fuel from glycogen, and you've maybe gone to the toilet, but it just gives us a really general guideline as to how much you should be aiming for. So if it comes back at that, then you could kind of use that and say, okay, cool, well, I probably need to be having about 500 mils of fluid per hour. It might be higher, it might be less, but that's probably the best way that anyone can go about getting a better idea as to their intake. Because otherwise, you know, I could say like, yeah, maybe have 700 mils an hour, but everyone has pretty different sweat rates. So I think the best thing that you can do is, even if you just do it once or twice, just see how much fluid you're actually losing during training. We can do the math together. You can just send me the numbers and I'll do it for you. And we can just kind of then use that so that moving forward, you've got a goal for yourself. Like, hey, every hour I need to make sure I finish one of these flasks. So that's probably the first part. And then the second part would be obviously the electrolytes.
I was going to ask that.
So you're already doing a good job. You know, you've got electrolytes in one, you've got water in the other. Ultimately, we want to be getting those electrolytes in because what they do in the body is they help that water get from our stomach into the blood, which is where we want that water to go so that we're feeling adequately hydrated. At the end of the day, it doesn't happen very often, but if you're someone out there that only drinks plain water, that can lead to something called hyponatremia, which is ultimately low blood sodium. And that can cause things like dizziness, cramping, fatigue, nausea. So we really want to be getting electrolytes in with our drink mixes. So if you're going to try this trail brew, see how you go. From memory, it's got a pretty good sodium content. So even if you're doing kind of like one serve of that in 500 mils of water every single hour, that could be like a really good baseline for you. And if you do that exercise and we can kind of calculate like how many milliliters you're losing an hour, then we can maybe start to tailor the dose of the trail brew to the amount of water just to make sure that we're getting a pretty good concentration.
I love that. Thank you. I think that's such a good breakdown. I love understanding the why, that it's like, oh, the electrolytes help it get from your stomach. You're getting hydrated, but you're actually getting it out to the muscles, which I think is so important. The last little thing I'll just quickly ask you, if I do need to go to the toilet and I guess do a number two, or if I go and do a wee, or if I vomit, how important is it to try and replace what I get out?
Yeah, so I think in terms of if you're at the point during your race where you're throwing up, you know, something's obviously not sitting super well with your stomach, I think the best thing that you can do, and I tell my athletes this all the time, if you get to a point where you just can't take on any more nutrition, do the best that you can to at least get some fluids down. Because, you know, if you were stranded in the desert, you're going to die from dehydration before you die from starvation. So I think if you do get to the point where you've thrown up, you've obviously lost some extra bodily fluid. So if you can just keep sipping on something like the trail brew, that's probably going to be the best way just to gradually get that in. If you need to go plain water because that's what's sitting well in your stomach, that's fine. But maybe that's where it can be really helpful for you in your preparation, just to maybe have some salt tablets as well, like or checkpoint bags or something like that. Because if you're not taking on a flavored drink mix because you just need that plain water, what you can do to help replace your electrolytes is like maybe take a salt tablet as well. When it comes to going to the toilet, that's kind of just like natural. So we don't necessarily need to worry too much about replacing those types of fluids. But if you are, yeah, getting to the point where something's upset your stomach, you're feeling quite ill, the best thing that you can do is just really small, frequent sips of fluid and trying to get back in electrolytes. So ideally sipping on something like the trail brew or maybe even Coke, that can settle, you know, a bit of a funky stomach. Again, it can be a little bit concentrated for some people. So maybe even alternating between some Coke and some water.
Amazing. This has been such an eye-opening chat. As I said at the start, this is probably the one that I've been the most excited about. I know nutrition is so important for endurance running, and you've given me such an incredible breakdown. I'm so grateful for your time today. I know you're a busy, busy woman with lots to look after. You guys at the Fight Dietitian do such amazing work, working with people like Alex Volkanovski and Israel Adesanya and stuff. How is it working with those guys? Cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool for sure. I remember when I did my first like UFC weight cut with the crew, I was like, oh my gosh, am I qualified enough to do this? You know, it's like that full imposter syndrome that comes back. But yeah, it's awesome to see. And I think, you know, working with combat sports and never having any personal experience in it, it's definitely given me a greater appreciation for the sport. And, you know, my athletes, they train like animals. They just give so much to the sport. So it's really cool just to work with like-minded people who, whatever their sport is, that they've obviously got that huge passion and it just drives them. So it's a very unique sport to be in. But yeah, I love it.
Yeah, it's so cool. I've listened to some Jordan's podcast and just like hearing how detailed and how like the nutrition is like tenfold important for them when they're getting weighed to try and make weight, which is a whole nother conversation for another day. Today was about endurance sports. So I just want to say thank you so much from the bottom of my heart, from the Good Human Factory community. I know everyone who's been following this 100-day to 100K journey, and anyone who is an endurance athlete or just anyone who's listened to this episode who eats food and drinks drink, which is everyone, would have learned something today. So thank you so much. I will leave in the show notes every way people can find you on your Instagram, the website you guys have as well, to get in touch if they want to do some personalized nutrition plans with you to improve from a personal point of view, or even if they are chasing down a sport endeavor like myself, trying to get in a position to finish or to perform and excel while they're doing it. So thank you so much. I do finish every episode with the same question, and I'm very excited to hear your answer. So what does being a good human mean to Lauren Nash?
Ooh, I think it probably means living a life that you enjoy and that fulfills you, but also having probably the balance of doing things for other people as long as it doesn't put you out, I would say. So I think it's a good balance of like, looking out for yourself, but also acknowledging that sometimes you need to be selfless and making the lives of other people around you better as well.
Very beautifully put. Well, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure getting to chat to you. Last thing, have you seen this stuff before, Drinker Rapper?
I have, but I have never tried it.
Oh, well, I'm going to send you some cases. So Drinker Rapper is sponsored by this podcast and the work that I do for almost 2 years now. Incredible humans, all neuroscience tested to make your brain perform better short term. It's got New Zealand neuroberry, like the anthocyanins from the purple foods, I think is good for your brain. And then a pine bark extract, and then also L-theanine. I'm going to get them to send over a couple of the cases for you to try, because I'd love to know what you think of it. And yeah, thanks to them for sponsoring the pod. So thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you, Lauren, for your time. Thank you for your energy you put into helping people with their nutrition. And yeah, thanks so much for coming on Good Humans Podcast.
Thanks for having me, and all the best for your 100K. If you need some proper advice, I'm more than happy to send you a message of some guidelines. So good luck, and I can't wait to see you achieve it and hopefully inspire one other person to run 100Ks.
I will take you up on that proper advice, but I feel like I did get some proper advice through this episode, so don't you worry about that. But thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Awesome. Thanks, Cooper.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.